the God who makes himself known is a God who shows himself to be unimaginably powerful and unrelentingly compassionate. And those two things held together are what we see in God delivering his people with a strong right arm, power, and great mercy and compassion as he remembers the promises. The God who makes himself known is the God who always keeps his word.
Welcome to Help Me Teach the Bible. I'm Nancy Guthrie. Help Me Teach the Bible is a production of the Gospel Coalition, sponsored by Crossway, a not-for-profit publisher of the ESV Bible, Christian Books and Tracts. Learn more at crossway.org. And our guest today on Help Me Teach the Bible is Kevin DeYoung. Kevin, thank you for being willing to sit down with me to help us teach the Bible.
Well, I do like to teach the Bible and help people teach the Bible.
I know that about
you. So that'll be good.
Perfect. A perfect match. All right. So you were just recently, and I mean, as we talk, last week, named the new senior pastor of Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina, right, as well as assistant professor of systematic theology at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte. So as we talk, there's about to be some really big changes in your ministry.
Yes. So very excited, sad too.
Yes, because I mean, this means you're leaving a place you've been for, 12 years?
Yeah, almost 13 years. So you know how these moves go. If we could just go there and take everyone with us. So we have loved being at University Reformed Church in East Lansing, and you know, our family was born there, raised there, and so this is a really big move to move to the Charlotte area, but we are excited, and we feel like the Lord's hand is in it, and we've been very warmly welcomed and received, and you know some of the people there, and you've been there. You've been there more than I have, probably.
No, that's not true.
At Christ Covenant, but we've had a wonderful, well, I've only been there one Sunday.
Seriously?
As well, when I was preaching, and then they voted and sequestered us in a room. But it's been very encouraging. We're looking forward to the move. And then to the partnership with RTS, and you and I both have many friends there, is really exciting.
Absolutely. So many people, they know you for your blogging at the Gospel Coalition, which, can I just say, I am always relieved when something comes up and I see that you have written about it. I don't understand how you can so quickly process an issue and then write about it so definitively and so publicly and honestly so helpfully. So I'm really grateful that God has given you that ability.
Well, that's very kind. It's nice to know that when I hit post that maybe somebody's reading it. Although sometimes you know what it's like. I hope nobody reads this. But yes, it's if I can find the time to do it. And my grid is always, are people in my church talking about this? I'm not looking to enter into
conflict. Every argument.
Yeah, and try to come in and be the blogging pope. I'm just, okay, people I know are wrestling with this. Maybe I can say something.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you're the author of many books, including Just Do Something, which my son's little small group is working through right now.
Good.
Just love that. Yeah. What is the Mission of a Church? That's been a very significant book to me and to David. A Hole in Our Holiness. Love that book. Taking God at His Word. That's had a tremendous impact over recent years. Care to tell us what you're working on right now? Give us a little... I won't tell anybody.
Yeah,
we
won't
just
tell
us right
what
here.
Am I working on? I'm trying to finish my PhD. So
that's right.
One
so
of
tell
the
us
things.
On what?
On John Witherspoon.
Are you going to write a book out of that? No, I am excited about it.
Okay.
Hey, I just finished Christian History 1 and Christian History 2. So, you know, if you'd talked to me a year ago, I kind of wouldn't have known who he was necessarily.
Yeah.
But now I do. So I'm interested.
That may. We'll see when I get done. I'm hoping maybe a year or so to be done with the dissertation, Lord willing. And then some books I have. A little book with Crossway, kind of a follow-up from The Biggest Story, but a board book for a real little kid.
All right, and The Biggest Story is a children's book.
It's a children's book. And then I'm working with Crossway and Don Clark, the same illustrator. This is like a multi-year project to do a big children's Bible in the vein of The Biggest Story that will have like 100 stories in it that I'm working on slowly, and Don is probably working full time to draw all those illustrations. And then, speaking of Exodus, I am again with Crossway going to do a book on the Ten Commandments.
Are you?
Yeah, and then sometime down the line with them, something on the Lord's Prayer, something on the Apostles' Creed, kind of a catechesis trilogy of sorts.
Oh, that's exciting to know. We have the inside knowledge.
So there you go. You heard it first.
The Bible. Yes. I like that. All right. Well, tell us a little bit about how your own Bible teaching ministry develops. Can you remember the first time you opened up the Bible in front of some people and boldly began to teach it, or timidly began to teach it?
Yes, I can remember teaching it. I'm not sure if it was bold or timid or how good it was, but probably way back when I was in high school.
Really?
Yeah, I think of some of the, you know, the youth group would get the youth service. Mm-hmm. It was always a little bit grim, but I first, you know, for some reason it was usually, well, somebody's got to give a 15-minute message. Kevin, I think you should do that. And so I remember doing one or two of those, and then I remember by the time when I was a senior in high school, I'd gone to a Bible study that met before school. I went to a public school, and we met before school on Fridays. And then all of my friends were taking AP Biology, which met early in the morning, so they weren't there anymore. So I was the only one left standing because I wasn't in AP Biology, thankfully. And so I started to lead that group. And, you know, I remember a mom from the, you know, we were in her house one morning. She was over listening. She was overhearing. And, you know, just these little encouragements that people mm-hmm. give that mean so much, especially when you're young. And I'm sure you've had those sort of things. And even when we're not young, they mean a lot. And she said, I was listening as you were teaching, and that was good. Something just simple. And, I thought, okay, maybe I kind of like this. Maybe I can do this. And so, you know, going into college and had more opportunities and took some more leadership roles and things.
When you went into college, did you think I'm headed toward word ministry?
I had thought since I was in sixth grade that I might be a pastor.
Really?
I had, yes. My quick story, my pastor who left when I was in sixth grade to go to another church, we were close to his family. I was terribly sad. I was crying. And he said, Kevin, someday you're going to do pulpit supply for me. And I thought, put the tissues in there or the glass of water? What do you actually, what are the supplies?
What does that mean?
Yeah. He said, no, you're going to,
in sixth
you're gonna
grade, he said that to you.
He did.
Wow.
Maybe he said that to all the sixth graders.
I don't think so.
He may have. We had a close relationship. So since then, I had thought maybe this was something that I would do. And it wasn't like, you know, it was just a straight line and started preaching in the nursing home in seventh grade or something. But I had thought about it. And so by the time I went to college, I started out majoring in political science, and I was all in that world. And then after about a year of that, I said, I want to proclaim what is true, not trying to sell it, not at all disparaging people involved in politics, but that's just what I felt like my calling was. And from then on, it was pretty clear that this is what I want to do. I wanted to teach the Bible. I had a real hunger to learn it. Could have used some Nancy Guthrie books, but just...
Who were models to you as you worked on developing your skills at being able to handle the word well? Are there certain models that you thought, okay, I want to do that? Or were there certain ways you saw people teach the Bible that you thought, don't want to do that?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there were those. Thankfully, it's the good ones that stick out more. I was very, you know, when I went to Hope College, and at the time, Ben Patterson was the chaplain, who's now at Westmont, and some people know of Ben, but not a whole lot of people in our circles. But his preaching just invigorated me. I mean, I was really captivated by it. And for a lot of people, college was a time of a lot of growth, like a weed in, you know, the good sense, and yeah, there's a lot of weeds here too. So his preaching was really key. You know, I went to a Baptist church with a guy who preached an hour long and just went through the Bible. And I grew up in a Reformed church, which also, you know, preached the Bible. But this guy just went through it line by line, verse by verse. And it was a different kind of church than I'd been at before. You know, I grew up and never heard a sermon on Daniel or Ezekiel, and also I'm in this independent fundamentalist Baptist church, and it's the 77s all the time and all these things. So I didn't quite get all, track with all of it, but that was good. And then, you know, just the books that I was reading. Lloyd-Jones was huge in just, you know, when I found Lloyd-Jones and Preaching and Preachers and the Ian Murray biography, all of that, thought, well, I'm never going to preach like him for sure. But I love the passion he has. And I sometimes tell young men, and this would be true maybe for men or women wanting to teach in some way, I'll say, if you can read Lloyd-Jones' Preaching and Preachers, one, if you agree with everything, you're in trouble because you shouldn't agree with it. I mean, he's so opinionated. But I say, two, if you don't have some passion to teach the Bible after reading that, then maybe you're not called to teach the Bible, because it had such a gripping, galvanizing influence on me and on many others. So that was really key. And then his sermons and preaching and John Piper and others. But yeah, there's a lot of good formative influences. You're asking me all the questions. I want to know who were yours.
That's not what we're here to talk about today. But thanks for asking. No, what we're really here to talk about today is Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
Because in August of 2015, you started teaching through the book of Exodus at your church. It's now April.
It was that long ago.
Yes. It is now April of 2017, and you're just in what chapter? Because you're not quite finished, are you?
I'm not. And with the transition to another church, you know, one of my members...
You're going to have to rush it?
Yeah, one of the members said, are you going to finish Exodus? I want to know how it ends. So I got through chapter 24, and now I've skipped ahead to Golden Calf in 32, 33, and 34, and then I'm going to skip ahead to chapter 40 at the end. So I am not done. Lord willing, I think when I get to the new church on Sunday night, I may pick back up with Exodus just so I can, I got to finish the book myself.
So this is a lot of sermons you've done on Exodus.
It is, yeah. We're coming up on 2 years.
Why would you, and therefore then speaking to other people who may be, they're trying to decide, maybe they're listening to this and they're thinking, what am I going to teach next fall? You know, what am I going to pick up and lead my group through? Why would you want to study Exodus at all? And why have you given it so much weight, mm-hmm. so much time?
Mm-hmm. I love to teach from the Old Testament. I love it because you get to connect the dots to Christ, and sometimes people haven't seen those or thought about those before. And I love that there's some familiar stories that everyone says, oh, I want to hear this story again. And then there's some weird, strange stuff, and you get to teach people things they hadn't seen before. So I love the Old Testament. Exodus, I mean, every book is important, but Exodus is one of those absolutely foundational books. I mean, in the Old Testament, you Genesis, Exodus, the Psalms, Isaiah. I mean, there's just some of these high water marks or low water marks, I guess, as they cross through the Red Sea. So it's been wonderful to preach through, and I think there are so many connections to the New Testament and so many ways that we need to hear some of these stories again. And as we're going to talk about, there's a whole lot of the book that doesn't have to do with the plague. I mean, it's not the plagues, it's not crossing through the Red Sea, and yet it's hugely important and foundational for the rest of the Old Testament and into the New. So I have loved preaching through it, and by that timetable, you can see we're going somewhat deliberately and slowly through the book, coming up on 2 years now. But there's just so much in here. Now, many people listening to this won't be able to do, or you know, might not be wise to do that sort of pace, but there's so much in here, there's so much to learn and to look at, that it, I think, served our congregation well to go through slowly over a couple of years now.
Well, we'll be linking at the website to your sermon series so people can tune in and listen. But let's say that we're speaking to people who have more like 10 to 12 weeks to do this book. Maybe what you could do is talk about, just give us an overview in terms of what are the big chunks that are going to help give us a layout of the book of Exodus that helps us figure out, okay, how am I going to break that down to just do it in maybe 10 or 12 weeks?
Yeah. So the major sections would be first chapter 1 through 15, which is the Exodus story. This is what we're familiar with. You have the call of Moses and the cry of the people, and God raises up a deliverer, and the stories that many of us know, and then sending the 10 plagues and leading them through the Red Sea, and then the Song of Moses. So those are the first 15 chapters. For many of us, we think that's the good stuff. That's the stuff we learned in Sunday school, and it's all really good. My advice would be, if you got 12 weeks, don't spend 11 weeks on getting
in a story.
On getting through those 15 chapters. Don't do a week on each of the plagues, or you're not going to make a good pass at this. So that's one. And then you have chapter 16, 17, and 18, which is the initial, it's not wilderness wandering, but it's the trek in the wilderness as they make it from the banks of the Red Sea to Mount Sinai. And there's a nice little section in there where each step of the journey is kind of a different lesson in discipleship and grumbling and trusting and all of that. So there's a little section. And then you get to the foot of Mount Sinai in chapter 19, and you have the giving of the law in 20, this covenant, which goes until the confirmation ceremony in chapter 24. So that'd be kind of a third section, chapter 19 to chapter 24. And you're going to have some familiar stuff, Ten Commandments, and you're going to have some laws that seem strange and odd to us. So you spend a little time there. And then there's sort of two main sections left from chapter 25 onward. Chapter 25 through 40 is largely about, first, the instructions on building the tabernacle and the priesthood and the ark, and then almost all of it gets repeated again, which is boring to many of us, but it signifies this was really important, because then they build the thing. So that's that. And then in between, you have chapter 32, 33, and 34, which is the golden calf. So I would say those would be, what is that? Are we up to five kind of main sections? Exodus, getting to Mount Sinai, the law at Sinai, the laws about the tabernacle and the worship, and then in between that section with the golden calf, and of course then it culminates with chapter 40 with the glory cloud, then filling the tabernacle, which is really Mount Sinai come down to dwell in the midst of the people.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that chapters 1 through 15 are, in many ways, very familiar stories.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, that's an opportunity because people are kind of familiar with it. And some ways, as teachers, it almost presents more challenge, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
Because we think we know what it means. We've got kind of, especially if we grew up in church learning Bible stories, we think we know what it's about. So as teachers, is there anything, any input you can give us on how to almost disrupt the deeply ingrained understanding of some of those Bible stories to help people see them with fresh eyes?
Yeah, you need to make sure that people aren't thinking of Charlton Heston. They're not thinking of the DreamWorks movie. They're not thinking whatever the last movie is. You know, we're such visual people. We've seen these things. So you need to help people disrupt that sort of mental picture sometimes. You know, I think there's so much in those first chapters that are connecting to New Testament themes, to the person of Christ. I mean, when you talk about Moses, okay, here's a man who was living as a prince in a palace, who leaves all of that to identify with his people, to be misunderstood, to be mistreated. Okay, so for many people, even who have grown up in the church and they know the stories, when you start spinning that out and then they see, oh, this is like, and it's not a, you know, we're not doing this in a superficial way where every story ends with, and there's Jesus. But you're saying, oh, this is really good. We're meant to see more than just Moses here, but there is a greater prophet who's coming, who identified with his people to be suffered and mistreated. So to make those arc of the biblical storyline connections is really helpful and sometimes disruptive, and can help people get out of, this is just kind of a cool story about how God did some amazing things. It is that, but there's a lot more going on.
What you just described, I think it does something deep in those we're teaching if we can accomplish that, for them to recognize this sovereign God over history. He is bringing about this experience in his people, demonstrating for us what he is going to do in a greater way in the work of Christ. And for people who have come under our teaching, and maybe they have always been in teaching that's always so pragmatic,
mm-hmm.
getting at, okay, so, you know, what does this mean to you? What are you going to do from this? It can really be eye-opening, people, to change their whole understanding of the way they approach the Bible.
Yeah, and as you know, the New Testament makes so much of the Exodus as the really foundational example of deliverance.
And even in the Old Testament continues to do it. It keeps looking back at what happened here and saying, this is really big what God did here.
Yeah, and to show who God is and to show that he's a deliverer. And then to show that he not only can deliver us from Egyptians, but from the power of sin, self, Satan. And so this becomes the quintessential story of God's power to deliver his people from all manner of slavery.
Well, let's dive into Exodus a little bit. It's going to be really hard not to get stopped because it's also fascinating to talk about. But perhaps you can talk about, because it's always hard to figure out, just how to start. And there are several things in this first chapter that connect to the preceding book mm-hmm. of Genesis that maybe when we're getting started, maybe we want to note. There's fruitfulness or multiplication of this family in Egypt. And certainly we could connect that to the commands early in Genesis to be fruitful or even after the flood, or the promise to Abraham of numerous descendants. As we work along here, we could connect Pharaoh's murderous intentions toward the Israelites to the enmity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Perhaps there's other ways to set Exodus in its place in the Bible story. How would you go about doing that as we get started?
I would listen to all those things you just said. That's really good. Now, yeah, it is a continuation, even the way that it's so obviously connected to the very end of Genesis. And now there arose a king in Egypt who didn't know Joseph. So we're fast forwarding. Things were good, and Joseph had the Lord's blessing. But as you said, these deliberate echoes from the book of Genesis are meant to show that God's people at the beginning of Exodus are described in this position of blessing. Now, very quickly, we're going to hear they're slaves, but blessing in that they're the creation mandate, they're reproducing, they're multiplying, the Abrahamic covenant, as you said, that God has blessed them and made them fruitful. I think that's the major connection. God made this promise to Abraham. He was going to make a great nation. And now, if you know this cliffhanger, you leave in Genesis and there's 70 or 75 people there, and they're, you know, at least going to survive the famine. And now you pick up the story and they're teeming, they're swarming, they're everywhere, and God's blessing them. And you have this opposition. But of course, the promise to Abraham was not only, I will bless those who bless you, I will curse those who will curse you. So this one, Pharaoh and the Egyptians who are going to be at enmity and curse the Israelites are, we should know, this is not going to go well for the Egyptians, because God promised to bless his people and to curse those who curse them. And so very quickly we get into the predicament, and then we start slowly but surely with the midwives and beyond mm-hmm. to get into how God is going to save these people, because he promised to bless them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the midwives. Yeah. I mean, when we're teaching through the book of Exodus, this is the first time we really expect people to raise their hands in our class, and they say, but wait a minute, they lied. They misrepresented what happened. I mean, that doesn't seem very Christ-like. And we have sometimes that can totally stop people we're teaching, because they just don't know what to do with this. They're not going with the bigger story of what's mm-hmm. happens here.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with something like that?
You know, there's so many ethical considerations, and even in in our tradition or among our friends, probably, how do you view the lies like this or like Rahab? People might disagree. I tend to see those as not sinful. I don't see that the narrator here, Moses, is condemning them for it. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, maybe you're just passing that over. But I sort of think of it as, if you're in a time of war, is it to be expected that you tell your enemy where your troop movements are? If they come to you and say, I'm a spy from the enemy lines, and I want to know where your troop movements are heading. Do you have an obligation? So some people disagree and say, well, you under all these circumstances, you ought to say, you know, they shouldn't have said what they did. But I see how Moses is drawing this out, and it sure seems to me that they're meant to be seen as heroes, mm-hmm. heroines in the faith. Now, depending on the study, I may not get into all of that, because then as you said, the study becomes, well, what about, you know, Corrie ten Boom and, you know, Nazis knock on your door, and it becomes an ethical class about, is it ever right to lie? And that's something that, you know, has stumped people for a while, and you're going to, you know, parse it out in different ways. So I think you sort of say, well, we could have an interesting discussion there. Maybe you say a few words, and then you want to move on. You say, but the main point here is not to give us an ethical case study about whether you can lie to your enemies or to your persecutors, but to see the courage in Shifra and Pua. And what I love in chapter 1 and chapter 2 is you go from there, and then you go to Moses's sister later, and then you go to Pharaoh's daughter. You have in these opening chapters God's plan of deliverance is unfolding, and it unfolds entirely through women at the first, and entirely through women who are caring for children, caring for their family, looking for the well-being of little people. And now, whether you're teaching to women or not, I think there's something very powerful that you have God's greatest act of deliverance in the Old Testament unfolding through a series of women, some who knew God of Israel, some who didn't, but through women, and through them embracing the calling God gave to each of them to care for the children as the midwives, to care for this child as an adopted one for Pharaoh's daughter, and for Miriam to run off and to help her mom and care for her brother. I just think, man, I love to teach on that.
Wow, I've never seen that. That's beautiful. Also, what's happening here, isn't it, is that we have to recognize these are God's people,
mm-hmm.
and these are the people through whom this promised seed, this promised one, is going to come. And this is one of many places throughout the Old Testament story where the people of God are being threatened. I mean, if all of the Hebrew baby boys are killed, then it puts this promised one who's been promised to come, it puts him at a threat. I mean, this is one of many places. You said earlier, you know, we don't want to too artificially get to Christ, but that's a way to get to Christ and show how this fits in the whole story of the Bible, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have obviously the connection with the slaughter of the innocents in the gospel story, that again, another jealous, fearful, murderous, vengeful king who sets out to stamp out these people, and he does so by trying to kill all of these little children. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, you see, again, the seed of the woman and the serpent and enmity, and the attempt by this dragon, to this serpent, to want to crush the people. And he's doing it here through Pharaoh, just as later through Herod.
In these early chapters of Exodus, we get a pretty brief version of Moses' birth and his growing up, his identification with his people, and then going into exile in the wilderness. Give us some insights into this person of Moses. And as we teach through the book of Exodus, there are some ways in which he is an example to us, certainly, but we don't want him to be merely an example.
I've gone several times in preaching through Exodus to 1 Corinthians 10, which, you know, references a few different incidences in Exodus, and then some of incidences in Numbers, water from the rock or wandering, or the pillar in the cloud, or the rebellion of the golden calf. And what's so helpful is it says these were given to us as examples. In this case, they're given as negative examples, that we may not pursue wickedness as they did. So we shouldn't think that to find examples in the Old Testament is unbiblical. Paul does that in 1 Corinthians 10. There are things here we're supposed to say, that's a warning. I shouldn't do that. Or there's something to emulate. So it's not that we're opposed to seeing examples from the life of Moses. It's not an either or. It's a both and it's a both and that gets the priorities right. So if you teach through Exodus and you're just looking, if you're thinking Moses is the main character, then you got a problem. The line that I've given throughout the book of Exodus, and this is from a book by the same title, I've said, Exodus is about the God who makes himself known. It's not about life lessons from Moses. It's about the God who makes himself known. Now, as you talk about Moses, there will be plenty of occasions to talk about his growth in leadership, the leadership lessons in chapter 18 from Jethro, and how Moses, I just preached through Exodus 32. I'm in that right now. And you see, Moses has grown and he's embraced his role as a mediator, as an intercessor. And so I talked about, we want to pray for each other. That's a lesson about what we want to do. And Moses is an example, but you don't stop there. So it's not cutting that out. It's just saying you don't stop there, because how can you talk about Moses as an example of intercession for the wicked without also saying, and there is an intercessor now at God's right hand. And it's not Moses. It's the Lord Jesus who intercedes for us. So by all means, find those examples in the life of Moses. Mm-hmm. Study it. But we shouldn't think the book of Exodus was written because a publisher said, Moses, you got it. Man, these are crazy stories. You got to get this down. This is going to be a bestseller, and you got to write this down. Moses' burden was to show and make known the God that had made known himself to Moses and the people.
When we get to the book of Acts, Stephen provides us some insight into this question about who Moses was.
What we don't quite see clearly in Exodus, Stephen says that Moses was looking, when he avenged the Hebrews, that he was looking for the people to embrace him as a leader, as the deliverer. So we see here that from the very beginning, Moses has the personality, the calling of a deliverer. And we can see that from the very beginning, this passion for justice. And you see that all throughout, because he goes from there, and then it's not too long before you see him at the well with the daughters, and he drives off the people who are coming to cause trouble. So here's a man who does have this penchant to want to stand up for the little guy, stand up for the people that are oppressed. And so Stephen gives us that insight. You know, the great passage in Hebrews 11 about Moses by faith was doing this. He was giving up the treasures of Egypt so for the treasures of Christ. And so there's all of these great parallels to show what Moses, as an example, as a man of faith, but it's not Moses just as a man of faith, but the object of that faith, which we know to be the Lord and ultimately Christ.
That Hebrews 11 passage about Moses is one I find so fascinating, because, and it, I think it gives us an opportunity as teachers, don't you think, where for it to say specifically that he was taking hold of the treasures of Christ, because we tend to think of Old Testament that they didn't know who Christ would be. And so that can be actually very mind-bending for some of us if we think of the person of Christ being a New Testament only kind of hope. Doesn't it give us the opportunity to demonstrate that Old Testament believers were saved in the same way that New Testament believers were, that is, taking hold of the person and work of Christ. But we just have the benefit of seeing him much more clearly than they did.
Right. That's absolutely essential. And in that passage in 1 Corinthians 10 as well says they all drank from the same spiritual rock, and that rock was Christ. Did they know all about the Messiah as we did? No. But were they looking for a deliverer? And did they, in their appropriation and faith in Yahweh, appropriate that faith in the Christ who was to come? Yes. And it's important because, of course, we're going to get to the giving of the law, and a lot of Christians get confused and think, well, Old Testament, especially with the Mosaic Law, that was really salvation by works, and God gave them the law to say, I want you to obey this. And but now the New Testament is overturning that, so now people aren't saved by obeying the law, but they're saved by faith. And we want to say, no, there is continuity. There's discontinuity as well with the law, but there's continuity in how the people of God have been saved by God. And the law of Moses was given to a redeemed people, not to a people so that they might be redeemed. So in a way, Exodus goes gospel, then law. You know, we think of law leads to gospel, which it does in an existential way, but here it's literally gospel, then law. So we really want to understand that these laws in Exodus, and we relate to them differently mm-hmm. on this side of the new covenant, but it was a gracious law, and it was given by a gracious God to a people to whom he had already extended grace and mercy, because that's how God's people have always received salvation. Now, people have misunderstood it. They've gotten confused. They've said, well, no, we need to keep the law in order to be right with God, but that was never the way God laid it out, and we see that clearly in Exodus.
So if we trace the story of Moses, he wants to identify with his people, and he goes out, and of course he ends up killing an Egyptian. And I suppose this is really what Stephen was getting at mm-hmm. in Acts 7. Here is this deliverer. Moses is one in a line of many deliverers that the people of God reject. And so Moses is under threat. He leaves. He goes to the wilderness. And of course, that's where we have one of those Sunday school stories of coming to the burning bush.
Mm-hmm. You know, moving from chapter 2 to chapter 3 is where this God who makes himself known starts to reveal himself. As chapter 2 ends with one of my favorite verses. It's so poignant. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. He knew. And at this point, if this is a play, the stage is black, empty, barren. For 400 years, it seems as if, where is this God? Is he listening? What is he doing? They're crying out. And all we know at this point is God knows. And he hasn't unveiled his plan of deliverance yet, but God saw, heard, remembered, knew. Those four beautiful verbs linking back to the covenant. So then you come to chapter 3, and now the God who knew is going to be the God who is known. And so he comes to the burning bush, the angel of the Lord, which, you know, I would make the argument, it would be good for teachers of this book to settle this for themselves before they start out. Who is the angel of the Lord? I think it's the angel that is the Lord. It's an angelic manifestation of the Lord, and many people think some sort of pre-incarnate Christ himself. So the angel of the Lord meets Moses there, and you know that begins the famous dialogue. You know, later, who are you, and what is your name, and what should I say when the people come to me? So Moses is not yet fully aware of who this God of his fathers is, and so Yahweh is making himself known to Moses. So there's so many turning points, but this is one of them. Okay, the God who is always working behind the scenes is now pulling the curtain, stepping forward to show himself to Moses that he might raise him up as a deliverer.
I love that scene where when he asks, who shall I say sent me? And God reveals, for the first time, he reveals something about his personal nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me such, when we think about our current culture and what they think about the God of the Old Testament, it's such a surprising thing, isn't it? About what he wants to reveal about the essence of who he is.
Yeah, that he says there in chapter 3, I am who I am. That's my name. There's probably some relationship in the Hebrew between Yahweh and the verb to be or I am, that God, when he wants to define himself, name himself, is fundamentally as the God who is other, the God who is transcendent, the God who is holy, this God who is because he is. And then the beautiful thing is, it doesn't just stop with a God who is so far beyond us and scary, but then this God is going to draw near to the people of Israel and hear their cries and their burdens and intervene to save them and to deliver them. But that's only good news for us if we have a God who is very big and a God who doesn't need to do that for his own sake, but he does it for our sake. And we begin to see that. And Moses isn't getting it clearly. Moses goes through a series of dialogue here and disputes. He has a series of questions for God, but God's going to answer those questions and then some.
One important word or idea throughout the book of Exodus is this word serve.
Yeah.
I want my people to come out and serve me. The people have served Pharaoh, and Pharaoh must let them go so they can serve me instead. So as we're teaching through this book, how do we help our people understand the significance of that word really in the whole story?
That's great. You want people to understand part of what the book is trying to communicate is we all serve someone. We all serve something. And when God delivered them, we can, in our very Western, American, autonomous way of thinking, appropriate the story wrongly. Well, this is great. God gave his people freedom, and we define freedom as free to be yourself. That's not the freedom here. It is a freedom to serve the real God, not the false God. So instead of, just like you said, Nancy, instead of serving Pharaoh, it's serving Yahweh. Let my people go. You know, let my people go. And we forget the last, that they may go into the wilderness and that they may serve me. So the desire is that this God would be known, that he would be worshipped, and they would go from serving a cruel dictator to serving now a loving, benevolent, powerful Father God.
That's what makes it good news.
That's right. That's right.
It's because of who God is.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Another challenging part of the story of Moses demanding to Pharaoh that he let his people go to serve him in the wilderness is this repeated refrain that God hardened mm-hmm. Pharaoh's heart. It's actually said, it's expressed a variety of mm-hmm. ways, mm-hmm. which we probably have to walk through with our people. But that's a real struggle for a lot of people, just as it's – and the reason it's a struggle is – because we just wonder, is that how God works today and with my loved one who is far away from Christ? So just talk with us about how to handle this God hardening a heart.
Mm-hmm. There's really a good opportunity to teach here. Sometimes it's a generic sort of passive and his heart was hardened. Other times it's Pharaoh hardened his heart. Most often it is, and the Lord hardened his heart. So the age-old question of divine sovereignty and human responsibility, you're not going to solve that one in your 45-minute lesson. But there's some real good teaching points to say we clearly see both things. We see here Pharaoh was responsible for his wickedness. This wasn't God hardening his heart as if Pharaoh were sort of, no, Yahweh, I want to be so good. I want to love your people. And God says, no, I need to, and I twitched you into. So no, it's never God by some external coercion or compulsion, making good people into bad people. That's not the hardening of his heart. So Pharaoh was clearly responsible. And we can't shy away from those passages that say, God, in his sovereignty, that his glory might be displayed, because that's the reason he gives, and his power be manifest, hardened Pharaoh's heart. And we'll get to this later in Exodus 33. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. If this is a book about the God who made himself known, we're not knowing God as he wants to be known if we do not fully embrace he is a God who is sovereign and is not looking to defend himself to us, but he is looking to rescue his people and show his power through us and through those even who would oppose that power.
When we're teaching something like this, Kevin, there's an aspect in which we have to anticipate objections mm-hmm. that people are going to have. We have to understand the way people think about things in our modern world. But at the same time, as you're talking about Exodus being a book that makes God known, there's a sense in which we also just have to help people. Okay, here's how to, I understand your objections, but at some point you have to decide whether or not you're going to let the God who is revealing himself be God, or if you're going to try to make God in your own image. If you're going to decide, you know what, that's not a God I like, and so I want to, I have to somehow save his reputation here.
That's right. That's right.
Rather than let him be known as who he is.
Yeah, you know, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, and then the passages in Exodus 33 and 34, they're wonderful, but they do have that effect. I mean, they make us have to wrestle, who will have the final word? Will it be me and what God should be like and what seems safe to me and what I can understand, or will I let God be God? And of course, that was the wrestling in Pharaoh, because Pharaoh went back and forth, and each time he ultimately said, no, I want to be the God. I want to manage this God. I want this God to work according to my schedule and my dictates. And so to be like Pharaoh is not a good lesson from the book of Exodus. And exactly what you said, we do have to help people as we teach this. Not rude, not, you know, set them up and, you know, you just bring them right to Romans 9 and get the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. But to them say, okay, we need to look at what do these verses say? Not what do we want them to say? What do they say? And are we willing to embrace this God and let him embrace us, this God who is God as he defines it? And I remember teaching one time on some of these things and sovereignty and all these related issues, and a man after me, who'd been in the church a long time, he said, I felt like God was just washing me clean again. And he felt like to see God in this way was, when you submit to it, freeing, beautiful, and ultimately good, because it dethrones us and it puts God where he belongs.
What an incredible both aim for our teaching and a result that would be so, bring us so much joy, is that those we teach would have a sense of having their view of God, mm-hmm. where it is wrong, dethroned. And over the course of studying this book of Exodus, come to a place of submitting to knowing God in the way he truly is and wants to be known.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, so then we get into these plagues, and we want, just as we're not going to teach on them forever,
yes.
because they're all leading up to the big one, the
right.
final plague. And what an opportunity to present the gospel in this story of promised judgment and a way of salvation in the midst of judgment through the blood of the Lamb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is probably, if we're going to choose one section to really land on hard in terms of helping people understand the gospel, this is going to be it. What opportunities do you see in this story of the Passover?
Yeah, you're right in that you got 10 or 12 weeks to go through this, and you don't want to belabor the plagues. You do want to draw some basic lessons that, you know, each of the plagues are targeting some aspect of the pagan worldview of the Egyptians and the various gods of the Nile and of the frogs and of the sky and the sun. And so it is a relentless assault on the false gods of Egypt. So, you know, there's some good teaching points. And as you said, where we want to land then is with the Passover and the imagery that is so important for the rest of the Bible and for our faith, that God provides a substitute. God provides the blood. And to be among those who are saved is to be with those and one of those who are covered by the blood of the Lamb. So there's just so many parallels that we can find what God is doing. And if you trace that out, and then you talk about the sacrificial system that will result from this, and as it will go on for years and for centuries and centuries of lambs being slaughtered, this is just the beginning of it. And all the birds and all the bulls and all the goats and all the sheep, for years and years and centuries, the blood, the mangled flesh, the smell, the smoke, constantly on the altar of God, beginning here with the Passover. And then you have a chance to go and say, imagine what it was like when this wild-eyed prophet, John, says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. That must have been something to hear and to behold. And I think as you teach through this, people will love to see that. They will love to see how Exodus makes much of Christ.
And what's beautiful about that, we're training people, probably the people we're teaching, maybe they've studied John, the book of John, a whole lot more than they have Exodus. But if you haven't studied Exodus, then how can it really move you? How can you really understand the significance of what John says when he says that? Or how can you understand when you read the Gospels, when Jesus stands up at the Passover meal?
Right.
And instead of saying, this is the bread of affliction of our fathers that they had heard for centuries. I mean, what must it have been like there in that room on that night when he says, this bread is my broken body. And this drink is my blood. And what an opportunity both for the Bible to come together, but it's just another reason to teach Exodus because it adds to that moment when we teach it.
Absolutely. When you realize that this has roots that go all the way back to that first Passover meal, now finding its ultimate fulfillment in Christ.
And then we realize it was always meant to be about that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The next big scene is there at the Red Sea. And if all along we are understanding that God is writing a story here in the lives of his people that is showing us something about the bigger story of salvation, how does that really become the case here as they face the Red Sea?
There are these metaphors now, these word pictures that come throughout the rest of the Bible of passing through the waters. They will later have to pass through the Jordan waters. Jesus will, as a new Moses himself, have to pass through the waters as he is baptized in the Jordan. And then however we understand baptism in our tradition, it's certainly a sign of initiation into that covenant community through the waters. And so the picture of God parting the sea is leading his people through this terror and from this enemy that he might save them. And as you know the story, they feel like they're trapped. They feel like they are literally between a rock and an Egyptian hard place. And where do they go? And yet at the 11th hour, God makes a way. He always makes a way. And it's a reminder for us in our grumbling, this won't be the last time they get a little fretful, these Israelites, just like us, that God has not left them, that God has a way, and that this is going to be the picture of how God saves his people, just like in the flood, now through this flood that didn't come upon them, but came upon his enemies to lead them to dry land on the other side.
It's interesting, if we just step back from the content of the book of Exodus, when we get to this point, the literature itself changes. It moves from this historical narrative to poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Song, as that happens often in the Old Testament and even to the end of the Bible. I mean, when we get to the end of the Bible in Revelation, there's even a reference to the Song of Moses, right? But it's going to be different there in this great, grander Exodus yet to come. But as a teacher, can you just give us some hints of all of a sudden, is there something that shifts in the way we teach when we get there to Exodus 15 and we're working our way through this song?
I think you don't want to rush Exodus 15 because, as you said, all throughout the Bible, Salvation and singing. Salvation and singing. God did something amazing. We have to sing. And that's going to help the people that you're teaching. Why do we sing so many songs in church? Why are we singing? You might even in teaching this, it'd be a wonderful opportunity if you got a group of 5 or 10 or 50 to sing something. You ought to sing some salvation. And you go to Revelation, you see the song of Moses is in effect giving way to the song of the Lamb. Mm-hmm. And whenever we see this salvation, God's people ought to stop and pause. And so we stop and pause and look at Exodus 15 in our teaching that we might enjoy this celebration and the singing with them. Because the story is not just that God's people are saved, but they're saved that they might worship. And that's what we want to do.
This would probably be a good time to mention that when I interviewed Ligon Duncan on Numbers.
Oh, did he start singing?
We sang together.
Oh, well, okay.
At the end of the episode. And maybe I should have mentioned ahead of time that you and I should probably sing.
Well, yeah, what are we going to sing? We'll think of something.
Are you a singer?
I like to sing. Yeah, I sing.
Yeah,
I sing.
Yeah.
I don't have, I'm not the baritone that Lig is.
No, he's a good one.
Yeah.
So, but I love that idea of incorporating singing in the teaching of teaching a song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Exodus is about to make a big turning point here as they have crossed the Red Sea. And so, why don't we make a turning point and bring this episode to a close and pick up again? We'll begin again in Exodus 16, pick up our conversation there. But why don't you just close this part of the story, Kevin? As we're teaching Exodus, the God who is known, if up to this point of the story, what do we really hope has happened in our people as we have taught this early part of Exodus?
I would hope that by this point, people know, first of all, God wants to make himself known. So we want the people we're teaching to understand, God, this isn't you prying open the curtain of heaven so you can see God. This is God condescending, coming down, revealing himself to us. God wants to make himself known, and he wants to make himself known through you to unbelieving friends and family. So we want to get the kindness of God in making himself known. And then I hope that people would leave these first 15 chapters know the God who makes himself known is a God who shows himself to be unimaginably powerful and unrelentingly compassionate. And those two things held together are what we see in God delivering his people with a strong right arm, power, and great mercy and compassion as he remembers the promises. The God who makes himself known is the God who always keeps his word.
That's good news to us as teachers. It's not up to us to make God known. We want him to use us in that effort, but God has an intention to make himself known, and
that's
he will.
Right. Yep.
Well, you've been listening to Help Me Teach the Bible with Nancy Guthrie, a production of the Gospel Coalition, sponsored by Crossway. Crossway is a not-for-profit publisher of the ESV Bible, Christian books and tracts, including Taking God at His Word, another book, Crazy Busy, and as we mentioned earlier, The Biggest Story by our guest, Kevin DeYoung. Learn more about Crossway's gospel-centered resources at crossway.org.